Wife, Mother, and Alcoholic, an issue for the 80s, sponsored by Beechwood Hospital, October 20th, 1983, in Atlanta, Georgia. This is cassette number 2, entitled, Woman Alcoholics, Are They Really Different? Presented by Dr. Ann Geller.
She's a delightful lady, and it's my privilege to introduce to you this morning Dr. Ann Geller.
Very much for that introduction. My name is Ann Geller, and I'm one of those 1%. The only thing was I didn't think I was that exclusive. I want to give you a little background to my introduction to alcoholism as a medical student and as a physician, to give you some idea of where the medical profession has been for these many years, as far as the disease of alcoholism is concerned. In the mid-1950s, the American Medical Association issued a policy statement stating that alcoholism was a disease. It took an enormously long time for this information to trickle down to the rank and file. When I was a medical student in the late 1950s, I was introduced to my first alcoholic family, and it happened like this. We, at that time, did home deliveries in England. And I was going out with the midwife on our bicycles in Paddington, and we were going to deliver a woman to the table with his head in his hand and a large bottle of whiskey by his side. And there was water boiling on the stove. In those days, whenever you went to do a home delivery, there was always water boiling on the stove. And this was the first time I understood what the water was for. The water was to heat up the whiskey, to make a hot toddy. And so we asked to be shown to the bedroom where the prospective mother was lying. And indeed, we went to the bedroom, and there was the prospective mother, and she was lying on the bed, and we shook her, and she opened one eye and passed out again. And by her side, there was another bottle of whiskey. And I tell you, it was the easiest delivery I have ever done. There were no complaints from Mom at all. No anesthesia, except the anesthesia she'd administered to herself. And there was absolutely no difficulty with the delivery. When we left the house, I said to the midwife, in all my innocence, they were celebrating a bit early, weren't they? And she said, they celebrate that way every day. Now, that was my first introduction to an alcoholic family. It is a family disease. The interesting thing, though, was that the word alcoholic was not mentioned. There was no idea on the part of the midwife or of the doctors who had been seeing this woman in the course of her antenatal care that there might be a problem which might be addressed by the medical profession. They just drank too much. That was all there was to it. It was a social problem. It had nothing to do with us. And we went about our way for more and more and better home deliveries. When I got to New York and started to work in Bellevue, a large metropolitan hospital, I worked on the neurology and psychiatry wards, and the vast majority of our patients were there because of the disease of alcoholism. Especially, it was very rare to find someone on those wards who was not there because of something connected with alcohol. Many of them had serious nerve damage, serious brain damage, as a consequence of their drinking. Some of them had got into accidents and had bumped their heads badly. And of course, as you know, the blood of our brain. And what we would do, we would patch them up and we would send them out. And we never, ever talked about the underlying reason that brought them into the hospital. We talked a lot about peripheral neuropathy, about alcoholic brain damage, and all of these things, and how to treat subdural hematomas. But we never talked about the disease that was responsible for all of these things in the first place. But I did learn, while I was at Bellevue, what alcoholism was. It was a disease of homeless men. That's what it was. And there was an occasional woman who found her way into the wards in Bellevue, but somehow we managed to ignore this fact. She tippled, you know, but she didn't have alcoholism, because to say that a woman was alcoholic was really to stigmatize her beyond anything that was reasonable in the medical profession. So we just didn't deal with the question of women being alcoholic. As the years rolled by, the situation has changed considerably. By 1970, there was a recognition, in fact, that there were such things as women alcoholics. They were very much like men alcoholics, and indeed there was no special consideration paid to them. In fact, one of the things that had happened as alcoholism began to be recognized was that it began to be a subject for a lot of research studies, and all of these were done on men. And Ittman, when women did appear in these studies, they were usually what the statisticians call noise. They were sort of got in the way of making a nice statistical analysis, so they were usually eliminated. He didn't know anything in 1970 much about the woman alcoholic. In the last decade, things have changed enormously, and there has been a great deal of research on the woman alcoholic, and there has been a gradually dawning awareness that although the disease of alcoholism is the same in men and women, there are considerations which make for differences. I don't think that this will come as a great surprise or as a shock to any of you that there are differences between men and women and that their response to having a particular kind of disease is somewhat different and that the response of society to them having this disease is also different. I think one of the things that is important to recognize, and I know it from my own personal experience, is that as women alcoholics, we are members of the same society as other women and other men, and we carry the same set of prejudices, and we feel all the feelings about ourselves that other people feel about us. We stigmatize ourselves in the same way that others stigmatize us. And I think this makes for a big difference between men and women, just on the basis of what the response is to the disease. Before getting too optimistic about the way things are going, I just want to put in a word of caution. There has been an enormous increase in awareness. There's been an enormous increase in the recognition that women alcoholics do require special services. But at the present time, the services for women alcoholics are still inadequate. They're not the kinds of services that are available for men. They very often are treated in treatment centers primarily geared towards male problems, male difficulties, male expectations. And also, as with any kind of funding, the last to come are usually the first to go. So it's important that we maintain a constant vigilance in the field of services for women. What I want to talk about now is some of the differences between men and women alcoholics. But before doing that, what I really want to emphasize is some of the samenesses, because I don't want you to go away from here thinking that somehow women alcoholics are a breed apart. They're very different from men in all respects. Alcoholism is a disease. It's a disease that affects both men and women. It affects them in many respects somewhat differently. But basically, it is the same disease. And I think for all that I'm going to say in the next 40 minutes or so, I want you to keep that fact very firmly in your mind. Because if we start emphasizing the differences too much, we'll begin to think of it as a different kind of disease process, which it's not. Women drink for all of the reasons that men drink. And women's alcoholic histories can be very similar to men's alcoholic histories. The classical woman alcoholic is the woman in her mid-30s, drinking alone, at home, coming into treatment, usually because her husband has left her. This is a particular kind of woman alcoholic. We see them. But there are also women alcoholics who drink exactly as men did, who drink at parties, in bars, with friends, socially, who are extroverted, who are not drinking alone at home, who are out in the workplace, who are having the three martini lunches, who are doing all of the things and drinking in exactly the same kinds of ways as men are drinking. There are also, just to look at the other side of the coin, drink alone and at home and who come into treatment because their wives have left them. I must admit that's a rather smaller percentage of men than it is of women, but it does happen. As far as the ratio of men to women, there has been an enormous change in the proportions. I think that the statistics which Conway just read out are probably about 25 years out of date, give or take a few years. In the 50s, the ratio of men to women coming into treatment was 10 to 1. In the 60s, it had crept up to about 5 to 1. In the 70s, the gap has been narrowing. We're catching up. In most of the surveys done in treatment centers in 1980 and in Alcoholics Anonymous, the ratio has been 2 to 1. We conducted Smithers annual surveys of our population, and our last annual survey was 3 men to 2 women. So we're catching up. And I think that it's important to recognize some of the reasons why this might be so. I think in order to do this, we need to look a little bit at some of the important risk factors in people becoming alcoholic. Probably the most important risk factor which men and women both share is a genetic risk factor. That is, having a family member who is an alcoholic places you at much greater risk for becoming alcoholic. If you are an ordinary member of the community, your chances of becoming alcoholic, if you drink, are probably about 1 in 12. If you have a mother or father who is alcoholic, your risk goes up to about 1 in 4. So obviously, there is an important genetic risk factor. Now, the question that everybody asks is, does this come about because you learn how to drink, as it were, at your mother or father's knee, and so you kind of learn your drinking patterns from how your parents drink? And is it nature? Do you inherit something which predisposes you to become alcoholic, or do you learn how to do it by watching your parents do it? And this nature-nurture controversy, I think, has been pretty well settled in favor of nature, that what happens if you take a bunch of babies who are adopted away from their alcoholic parents and who are reared by parents who are non-alcoholic, that the incidence of alcoholism is exactly the same as if they had been reared with their alcoholic parents. So what this tells us is that the disease is in some way, and for some people, genetically transmitted. The other very important risk factor is exposure. I know this sounds kind of obvious, but if you're not exposed to alcohol, you can't become alcoholic. No matter what your risk factors are, if you live in a country where you absolutely can't get a drink, there is no way that your risk factor is going to flower into the disease of alcoholism. However, if you live in a society where drink is available, then whether you become alcoholic or not is going to depend on how much you are exposed and what kind of exposure you have. And one of the things that many people think has protected women in the past has been precisely those stigmas which now are in the stand in the way of treatment of the woman alcoholic. That in fact women were not drinking in the same kind of patterns as men were. Drinking among women was not as accepted as drinking among men. Certainly, drunkenness among women has never been accepted in the way that certainly in my country and in this country, drunkenness among men is not only accepted, but it's almost a necessary rite of passage. You know, if you go to college, you've got to get drunk or you're not one of the boys. This is not true for women. If you just think for a while of the phrase, drunk as a lord, what does that mean? Expansive, free-spending, having a good time. Think of its equivalent. Drunk as a lady? What does this mean to you? Clearly, being drunk and the kind of drinking patterns that are accepted for males in the society have not been accepted for women. Therefore, the number of women who have been exposed to alcohol in the kind of way that men have been has been much smaller. So I think that in spite of probably similar predispositions in the two groups, you've had a very different kind of exposure, making for different rates. What we're seeing now, and especially among many of the studies in high school drinking, in grade school drinking, public school drinking, what we're seeing is that, in fact, the proportion of young girls drinking is rapidly equaling the proportion of young boys who are drinking. And what is even more alarming in terms of narrowing the gap, as it were, is that the number of young girls drinking heavily, that is, getting drunk at least once a week, is also beginning to be almost equivalent to the number of boys who are doing the same thing in grade school and in high school. So what we're seeing is an increase in the exposure of women to alcoholic drinking patterns which are dangerous. Now, I'm not saying that everybody who gets drunk is going to wind up being an alcoholic, but you understand that if you have the predisposing factors and you are in a society where drinking to drunkenness and heavy drinking is a part of the cultural pattern, then it is very likely that your predisposing factors will wind up with you being identified as an alcoholic. If you're in a society where almost no drinking is done, then the chances of your predisposing factors manifesting themselves are going to be much less. And I think this explains, in large measure, the differences between the two. However, there do remain some important ways in which women alcoholics are different from men. And I want to talk a little bit about these, because I think that they're important in our understanding of the woman alcoholic. There've been, by the way, a lot of theory about why people become alcoholic, and even more theories in the last few years about why women become alcoholic. Many of the theories had to do with basic psychiatric illness. That is, you become alcoholic because you have some psychiatric problems. And you drink because of the problem. The problem with this approach is that if you drink because you have problems, the necessary conclusion is that if you can solve the problems, you won't drink. And lots of people have spent lots of time in psychiatrists' office and on couches trying to solve the problems that cause them to drink. It doesn't work. Because, in fact, alcoholism doesn't come about because of psychiatric problems. And unfortunately, if it did, it would be very nice, because then, in fact, we could indeed identify people who have psychiatric problems which cause alcoholism, and we would have a nice way of preventing alcoholism. Unfortunately, this turns out not to be true. As studies on women alcoholics have begun to increase, there have been a number of theories of why women become alcoholics, and I think they can be encapsulated in what I would like to call the ornithological theory of women's alcoholism. It has to do with nests, you see. Women become alcoholic because they have empty nests, because they have full nests and they can't get out of them. They get to be alcoholic because they don't have nests at all and they wanted to have a nest. They get to be alcoholic because not only do they have to sit on the eggs, but they have to go out and get the worms too. All of these things are reasons for women becoming alcoholic. And you can pick up any newspaper or any journal and find somebody proposing one of these theories. I think that what this does is really divert us from the main reason why women become alcoholics is because they have an innate predisposition to do so and because they're exposed to alcohol. And they don't do it because of all of these reasons. I think that while these theories are kind of funny, they are quite dangerous because they do lead to the conclusion that if only we could change women's lives, we could stop them from becoming alcoholics. And I don't think this is true. Now, the natural history of alcoholism in women does tend to be, in a general statistical way, different from men. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't find a woman alcoholic who has a history exactly like an average male alcoholic, but as a group, we tend to have somewhat different histories. We start to drink later. When we do drink, we get into trouble from our drinking rather sooner, and we come into treatment somewhat earlier than men do. That is, we have somewhat shorter drinking history. We did a recent study at Smithers, and we whereas about half of our men had drinking histories which were 10 years and over, only about a fifth of our women did. And again, that does point to the fact that women get drinking. My prediction is, and I can be wrong, is that 20 years from now we're going to see very similar patterns in both male and females. But for them, what we have is a somewhat different drinking pattern in females. Women do come into treatment somewhat earlier than men do. And they do have fulminating. The physiology of women is different than the physiology of men in response to the drug alcohol. I don't think it should come as any surprise to you that women, as a general rule, weigh less than men do. And for that reason, women can drink less, just on a simple weight-for-weight basis. And I often think we don't realize that. You know, if a man can put away 8 drinks at a sitting, a woman, drink for drink, will not be able to do the same without getting more drunk than he is, because she weighs less than he does. And any drug is disposed in the body according to your weight. So women who weigh less than men will get drunker quicker. And that's just a simple sort of measurement kind of a thing. But there are some other physical things which are important as far as differences between women and men are concerned. Women, in fact, when given the same amount of alcohol per body weight as men, have a higher blood alcohol concentration. And it is thought to be due to the fact, you will pardon this, that we have more fat tissue than men do. And that this alters the distribution of alcohol within the body. So in fact, even when we drink the same amount on a weight-for-weight basis as men do, we have higher blood alcohol levels, which means we get drunk faster. The other thing which makes women different as far as their response to the drug alcohol is concerned is that when men take a standard number of drinks per body weight, if they take it on 1 week, they have the same amount of alcohol in their blood as they do if they drink the same drink the next week and the next week, provided they've eaten the same amount before drinking. So that men can pretty much predict from session to session how drunk they're going to be. You know, they know perfectly well that on Monday, 4 drinks made them feel a little high, so the chances are very good that the following Monday, the same 4 drinks are going to do the same thing, all other things being equal. This is not true for women. Women have fluctuations in the course of their menstrual cycle of their blood alcohol level, so that they cannot predict from week to week what 4 drinks are going to do. In fact, the blood alcohol levels are higher again on a drink-for-drink basis during the premenstrual period than they are at other times during the cycle. So, again, a woman who was drinking 4 drinks and getting high when she had just had her period may drink the same 4 drinks when she is just before her period and get a lot higher. So it's much more difficult for women to predict how drunk they are going to be than it is for men, because our physiology is somewhat more complicated. There is another thing which seems to be true of women alcoholics as opposed to men, and that is that we do tend to get physical complications from the taking in of alcohol more than men do. Now, in the old days, in the bad old days, when women alcoholics in treatment were a rarity, it was always assumed that for a woman to come into treatment, she had to be a lot sicker than a man. Indeed, this was true. And the reason this was true was because the stigma associated with the disease of alcoholism in a woman was so great that nobody was going to turn a woman into a treatment center, much less was she going to come in by herself. And so, in fact, a great many women alcoholics went unrecognized, untreated, unhelped until such time as their disease had caused terrible physical havoc. So that women coming into treatment centers in the 50s and in the 60s were in fact much physically sicker than men were because their disease had been diagnosed much, much later. By the way, assumed that they were much psychiatrically sicker because after all, you've got to be really sick to be a woman alcoholic, whereas, you know, kind of okay to be a man and be an alcoholic. So it was assumed not only were they physically sicker, but that we were also psychiatrically sicker. Nowadays, when women are coming into treatment centers much earlier, when the diagnosis in general is being made at probably the same time in the disease as it is with men, we do see, though, that women suffer more physical complications from the disease than men do. The incidence of cirrhosis of the liver seems to be somewhat higher in women than it is in men on a drink-for-drink basis. That is, you have to drink less if you're a woman to get cirrhosis than you do if you're a man. The other thing is that women are particularly prone to develop anemia as a consequence of alcohol abuse. Both men and women do because alcohol affects the bone marrow, it affects the blood-forming tissues, it affects your red blood cells, and it also affects your white blood cells, which is why alcoholics get a lot of infections. But with women particularly, the anemia can be quite severe, again, because women are in general more prone to anemia. And there is, however, a difference in the other direction, in that men are more likely to come into hospital with what is the major complication of alcoholism, and that is accident. That's the leading cause for people who have problems with alcohol to come into hospital. Because they have an accident. You know, you're trying to repair the roof after four martinis, and the chances are you may not stay on the roof. You know, you decide to take a trip to the cellar to get some more wine after you've already had two bottles, the chances are you may not make it down the cellar stairs. These kind of domestic accidents, as well as the accidents on the highways, are much more common in alcoholics and are a very common reason for alcoholics coming into hospital. And these traumatic accidents are somewhat more common in men than they are in women. And again, this may have to do with where people do their drinking. Similarly, the number of men who are arrested for drunken driving is much, much higher than the number of women are who are. However, if you actually ask in a treatment setting how many people have been behind a wheel when they've had too much to drink, the proportion of men and women who say yes are about equal. The problem is that women very rarely get arrested for this for all of the reasons that are both protective of the woman alcoholic and, in fact, are preventive of her getting into treatment. That is, that cops, like everybody else, don't want to call a woman drunk. And so they will not arrest them for drunken driving. And so, in fact, women don't get into treatment because of drunken driving arrest. So as far as the traumatic kind of damage, women have less of it than men do. However, there is one particular area, and I want to talk about this to some extent, because I think it's a very important area, where women really are much, much more vulnerable than men are. And that is the area of dual addiction. I did a survey last year, again, of the women and men in our treatment center in terms of the number of people who were dually addicted. That is, the number of people who were primarily alcoholic, but who, in addition, had become dependent upon another drug. And 22% of the male alcoholic, primary alcoholic patients have become dependent on another drug, and 51% of the women. Now, this is a big difference, and I think it points to some very important reasons. I don't think, again, that it says that women alcoholics are different in any substantial way from men alcoholics. I think that what this points to is a different way that society regards the woman alcoholic, and perhaps a different way in which she regards herself. Because of these 50% of my women patients who had picked up another drug, 75% of those 50% had had it initially prescribed for them by a doctor. And what happened to them? Basically, what happened to them is that women, as a general rule, tend to ask for help more than men do. They tend to go to doctors more than men do. We tend to be a little more open about when we're in pain and when we need help, and to be able to ask for it. Not as far as alcoholism is concerned, because that's a whole other issue, but as far as more likely to seek help to get some relief from it. So as a consequence, women, in fact, go to doctors more than men do. And women alcoholics are no exception to this general rule. They go to doctors more. Now, when you go to a doctor and you are telling this physician your symptoms, and if your symptoms are due to overuse of the drug alcohol, the chances are very good that that doctor, however honest and competent and honorable he or she is going to be rather unwilling to identify you as an alcoholic, and more willing to identify you as having something else. So what happens is that women go to their doctors. Women who are drinking far too much go to their doctors with some of the symptoms of alcoholism, which can be increased anxiety. When you drink a lot in the evening, you are anxious the next day. And most people who are drinking heavily do not recognize that the anxiety that they're experiencing during the day is a consequence of the drinking they did the day before. Like most people, they think that it's due to the stresses and strains of life, the difficulties of existence in New York or Atlanta or wherever you happen to be, the terrible marriage you're in, the awful boss you've got. If your wife nagged me the way my wife nagged me, then you would have the same kind of anxiety I have. Or if your husband gave you the same kind of hard time mine gives me, then you too would feel anxious. So people feel anxious and attribute that anxiety to something else, when in fact the anxiety is due to the drinking. The woman alcoholic may go to her doctor complaining of anxiety. She may go to him complaining of another very common symptom of alcoholism, insomnia. Alcohol really messes up your sleep cycle, something terrible. And what happens when people drink is that they often suffer as the alcohol begins to go out of the body in the early morning hours with early morning wakening. They wake up early in the morning and they can't get back to sleep. The reason they can't get back to sleep is that, in fact, their brain is hyperactive as a rebound from the depressant drug that they took the night before. So they wake up in the morning with this overactive brain, unable to get back to sleep, and they go to their doctors complaining of insomnia. As a consequence, often, of both the debilitating effects of the drinking, the anxiety, and the insomnia, they may also complain of fatigue. So, anxiety, insomnia, fatigue, depression. Very common. Alcohol is a depressant drug. Alcohol causes changes in the chemistry of your brain, which makes you feel depressed if you're drinking a lot of it. So depression is a very common symptom of over-drinking. Of course, depression is not uncommon as a primary problem for a lot of people. But unfortunately, what happens is that when an alcoholic goes to a doctor complaining of depression, it's very likely that they're going to be treated for the depression and not be treated for the alcoholism. And this is especially so if it is a woman who is going to the doctor with these symptoms. So what happens is that the woman goes to the physician complaining of these various symptoms, could be anxiety, could be insomnia, could be depression, and winds up with a prescription for something. Now, the marvelous thing about prescription for sleeping pills and for tranquilizers is that they work. If you are anxious because you have been drinking, a sleeping pill or a tranquilizer will do just as well as a drink of alcohol would. It'll correct the situation temporarily. Unfortunately, these women who go to doctors because of these problems don't know this. And they take the tranquilizer, they take the sleeping pill, it corrects the situation magnificently and instantaneously. And before you know it, they're on a cycle of using and substituting often the sleeping pills, the tranquilizers, for the alcohol. I'm very frequently doing both, as do many of my patients. So what happens then is, because women go to doctors more, because we as a profession are, just like everybody else, unwilling to acknowledge that women can be alcoholic, unwilling to confront a woman with this diagnosis, we're much more likely to reach for our prescription pads and prescribe some kind of drug for her. And the drug we prescribe is very, very often a drug which will also cause an addiction. Because anything that calms you down, that sedates you, that helps you to go to sleep, is potentially addictive. Gee, I'm glad it wasn't a real fire. Did you hear that? Well, you know, it's all right. There isn't a fire. We don't have to leave. You know, one of the things of about this business of dual addiction in women is that not only does it make us much harder to treat when we get into treatment, because we have just not one thing wrong with us, but two things wrong with us. The other thing is that a lot of the places that are geared to accept alcoholics won't take people who are dually addicted. And this is, again, a problem with funding, a problem organized, but it particularly has an impact on women. I can't get my women patients into halfway houses when they need to be in them, because halfway houses only accept alcoholics, or at least most of the ones in my area do. And they won't accept people who have another addiction. And this is particularly heavy on women, because more women have dual addictions than men do, whose primary disease is alcoholism. So this problem of overprescribing for women, of women becoming duly addicted, has a particular impact both on the course of the disease and also on the kind of treatment that's available. Also, I don't know if any of you have experienced this, it's not pleasant to come off alcohol, I can assure you. It's not one of life's pleasures. But coming off Valium is worse. And many of the drugs to which women get secondary addictions are even more unpleasant in terms of their after effects than alcohol, and also it takes much longer. So that we wind up often with women coming into treatment who not only have their alcoholism, but who also have now picked up a second addiction, which in fact is going to take even longer to treat. Now, in terms of the actual background to the woman alcoholic coming into treatment, I think there are some social differences between women and men which are important to know about. One is that many more women coming into treatment have been divorced or separated, or their husbands have left them, than is true for men. These women who have been divorced, separated, or otherwise abandoned come into treatment very often with very little in the way of external support. They don't have a spouse. They usually are not economically very solvent. They often have had to go out into the workplace for the first time and not in the best condition to try to find a job, so that they have rather tenuous job histories, and they're coming into treatment often with the care of dependent children. So they have a kind of triple jeopardy, if you like. They have their alcoholism, they have the fact that they are single family heads, they have the fact that they are often newly entering the job market because of their recent abandonment. Women coming into treatment have, in addition, some other psychological things which make them very different from men. Women alcoholics coming into treatment have all of the problems that male alcoholics do. There's a stigma against male alcoholism also. There is a feeling of shame, a feeling that one has somehow not had sufficient willpower to control one's drinking. But in addition, women have with them all of the problems that women have in our society. So they have problems connected with alcoholism, the same as men. They have particular problems connected with being women. That is, often not having a very strong economic basis for their support at the particular time, often having the care of dependent children, often not having had adequate training to support their family, economically speaking. And then, in addition, on top of this, they have the additional stigma of being a woman alcoholic. And that is indeed a stigma. If you sit around treatment centers long enough, you realize that you have to keep a very strong and firm hand on what is said, because the men alcoholics will imply or say directly to the woman alcoholics that you're much worse than I am. That you really let yourself go. I mean, a man being drunk is one thing, but a woman being drunk is some quite other thing. And the implications of what one does when one is a woman and one doesn't have control of one's actions, all of the sexual implications, all of the abandonment of children implications, much, much stronger for women than it is for men. And this is what women alcoholics face, coming not only out of the world where they're surrounded by people who don't understand about alcoholism, but even coming into treatment centers when they're confronted by their male peers who really feel themselves, just as most other men do, that alcoholism in women is very different, and that it is much more morally reprehensible for a woman to become an alcoholic than it is a man, because of all of the possible consequences and all of the toppling of the various pedestals on which women are put and from which she falls so far when she becomes an alcoholic. And all of these effects add up together. Women coming into treatment have infinitely more shame about themselves than men do. It's hard to measure shame. You know, there is no shame index. We have a depression inventory and an anxiety scale, but we don't have a shame index. But we should have, because in fact, women feel terrible about themselves when they come into treatment. They feel that they have failed in every aspect of their life. They have failed often in terms of their business life, as have many men. But they have failed most importantly in the area which is most crucial and central to a woman's existence, in their life as a woman. They have failed as a wife, and they have failed as a mother. And the evidence is there right before them. And those of us who work in treatment centers know that although men are often quite upset about the effect of their drinking on their family, they say, gee, yes, you know, I think that I didn't take my son to the baseball game and I promised I would and things like that. But it doesn't hit them right at the core of their being. It is not central. They have not failed in something which they consider to be their primary function and which society considers to be their primary function, the care of children and their function as a spouse. And in fact, women coming into treatment have an enormous reluctance to admit that their drinking has had an impact on their children, because that is so central to one's sense of oneself as a mother. And it's usually only after a lot of work and a lot of time has elapsed that women alcoholics will begin to come to grips with the fact that, yes, indeed, their drinking has seriously and significantly affected their family. And once they can accept that, then they can begin to do something about it. But to get that acceptance is extremely hard. I tell you, there is one thing that is equally hard I found working with another group of people. I work a lot with alcoholic doctors. And to get an alcoholic doctor to accept that his alcoholism has in any way affected his medical practice is almost as hard as getting a woman alcoholic to accept that her alcoholism has in some way affected her children. And I think for all of the same reason, that it is very central to the core of what she feels she's about and of what is most dear and important to her. And it's very hard to accept that this could have been seriously affected by her disease. So that women have enormously more shame in very important and central areas than do men when they come into treatment. They also feel terrible about themselves. Really terrible. There's a lot that's been written about women's self-esteem. Women's self-esteem is at an all-time low when they come into a treatment center for alcoholism. Women buy into all of the myths of the woman alcoholic that society accepts so readily. They think they're whores. They think they think that they have totally betrayed their femininity and betrayed their essence as people. And they feel absolutely incompetent. Incompetent as mothers, incompetent as wives, and incompetent in their careers. Whereas men usually have much more feeling about their careers than they do about the other areas. Even though the other areas may have been very significantly affected. So women coming into treatment are feeling really awful about themselves. In addition, they are coming into treatment without supports that men have. The kinds of support. Women, another little patient population. We refer to assistance programs, and these are programs within an industrial occupational setting where if his employer have with difficulties with job performance, referred to an assistance program, which if that problem is due to drugs or alcohol, will refer that person. Of the people who were referred programs and who were programmed during the past year, 75% representative of the labor force in this, and again, not only the different access that men have to treatment in the workplace, so the willingness of people in the workplace to identify problems in an employee as being due to alcoholism if it's a male, and their relative unwillingness. So again, this points to the different supports that men and women have in the community. Another very interesting survey, which was done by the New York City affiliate of the National Council, is people, an analysis of people calling in for help. They have a hotline, and you can call in for help if you want concerned who you are concerned about or yourself. Probably you think might have a problem with drinking, you can call this hotline, and they will give you some information and a referral and set you up in some way so that you can get some assistance. The ratio of women calling in about a male they were concerned with to women being called in about, to men who were calling in about women they were concerned with, was 10 to 1. That is, 10 times more women were concerned about a male drinker than were men concerned about a female drinker. Now, you know that these statistics are at least 2 to 1. Ratio of male to female alcoholics, not 10 to 1, which again points out something very important in the way the woman alcoholic has to cope with the reality of her situation. That is, she is not getting support from the people around her. People are not calling in about her, asking how they can help her. She, the woman, is calling in about men she's concerned about, but it doesn't seem to work so well the other way around. And I think this is again, very important when you think of how women come into treatment and what kinds of supports they have when they do get in. Now, how, in fact, do women do when they get into treatment? Given all the many things that they have against them, and I just want to recapitulate for you what some of those things are. They probably have worse physical complications. They have much more likely picked up a second addiction along the way. They are much more likely to be in an economically difficult situation. They are much more likely to be the sole support of dependent children. They are much less likely to have any kinds of social or environmental supports, and they are much, much more likely to be feeling really, really awful about themselves. How do they do? Well, we didn't really know because there weren't any studies to tell us how she did. But the general assumption is to be in the studies, in fact, to look at to look at alcoholics did do in college, it was found that, in fact, in so far that come out, women seem to do just as well as men do in terms of staying sober once we get into treatment. The trick is, however, to get us into treatment. Once we're in treatment, however, in spite of all of the many things which make it, in fact, harder to treat women, we, in fact, do as well as men do. In fact, there is not really any significant study which has shown that women do any more poorly. You know, some of the studies, women do a little better, some of them they do a little worse, some of them they do the same. Overall, it's the same. What is that treatment outcome? Well, most of the centers who report treatment outcome for women who have been in rehabilitation programs of a month or more will report that at the end of the follow-up period, which is usually 2 to 3 years, about 60% of the women will have been completely sober. That's not bad. You know, when I was working as a neurologist, I rarely made anyone better. I rarely helped to make anyone very much better. And in neurology, you hardly ever cure anything. You know, neurological diseases are not diseases which people get better from. Since I've gone into the field of addictions, my former colleagues have come up to me with long faces and sad looks and said, "How could you possibly work in that field? It's so depressing." You know, and I tell 60% of my patients get well after the first treatment. You know, can you tell me any neurological patient you've had who's gotten completely well? It's very rare. But in fact, there is such an atmosphere of gloom and doom about alcoholism treatment, and such a feeling that, in fact, alcoholism is an intractable, incurable, irredeemable disease, that we really don't look at the very good statistics that we have, which show us that, in fact, most people will do rather well if they, in fact, get into treatment. The thing that we have to get people into treatment is something which is called leverage, right? I don't know of an alcoholic who actually walked into a treatment center saying, "Help me." It doesn't happen. I wish it did, but it doesn't happen. It didn't happen with me. It doesn't happen with anyone else. You know, somebody has to give you a push. There has to be some reason why you're coming into treatment. With men, it very often that push comes from the job, from the employee assistance programs who've said, "You've got a problem, you've got to do something about it," and have shown them what to do. It can come from the legal system, where they've been arrested for drunken driving. It can come sometimes from the domestic situation, sometimes from a friend, sometimes from a religious person, but more often it comes from the job, from the law, from the family. Women don't have so much of the job and law access. And really, the major leverage with women is someone in the family saying, "You go into treatment or else." Unfortunately, what happens with women is it is much more likely that that significant other person is going to say, "I'm leaving. Bye." Rather than saying, "You go into treatment or I will leave." Because, in fact, and this is a feature of the economic situation of women, is that men have, in fact, much more mobility and can pick up and leave and are much less likely to stick it out and say, "I'm going to stay with you if you go into treatment." So that, in fact, as far as leverage for getting into treatment is concerned, women have less of it than men do. And one of the things that these kind of functions serve is to raise all of our awareness of the fact that women do have alcohol problems, that women are alcoholic, and how we might help to provide that leverage, to provide that intervention to get the woman alcoholic into treatment. Because that's one of the things we need to do. Once the woman is in treatment, she will do very well. She will do very well provided that there are facilities for her to do well in. Very often, unfortunately, she finds herself in a situation where, although she can certainly get into a home and she can almost undoubtedly get into a rehabilitation treatment center, she may not be able to go on and get into a halfway house because there are really not enough of those extended care facilities to take care of the women who need them. And this is, I think, an important area which we really have to think about in terms of women's treatment. I want to talk a little bit just quickly about another aspect of women and alcohol, and that is the woman as the co-alcoholic. I think that things are changing a lot, but in the old days when the concept of women as the spouses of alcoholics first came out, it was the whole concept of women as somehow enabling and helping their husbands to drink started floating around. And I know a lot of women who had a very tough time being told that if they weren't doing what they were doing, their husbands wouldn't be drinking. I think that a lot of that is changing. But I have a very good friend who was in fact told by her husband's psychiatrist that if it wasn't for her husband wouldn't have any difficulty with drinking at all. And if only she'd just stopped nagging him, he'd stop drinking. You know, I think that there is that other side of the coin which we also should look at in terms of the woman and alcoholism. I just want to conclude with telling you a little bit about how I got into treatment from my own alcoholism, just to say that at the time when I recognized, I think, no, that's probably not the right word, when it was very forcibly born home to me that I had some difficulty in the area of controlling my drinking. At that time, I was teaching in medical school. I was doing research on the effects of drugs on behavior. And I was teaching the medical students about a class of drugs called the sedative hypnotics, among which there was a one-hour lecture on alcohol. The last one-hour lecture I gave to the medical students at that particular medical school was a day before I went into a detox ward, and I gave it dead drunk. It, I think, was a terrific illustration, if only they picked it up. But I just want to say that I didn't recognize the alcoholism in myself, and I certainly had some of the tools, at least, with which to do so. And one of the overwhelming feelings that I had when I finally did come to grips with the fact that, indeed, it wasn't depression, and it wasn't domestic life, and it wasn't the stress and strain of doing research with rats. It wasn't any of these things. It was simple, old, plain alcoholism. And the thing that I had to come to grips with was my own incredible shame at being a woman, at being a woman professional, and at having this terrible disease, which I felt was entirely my own fault, and was something that I should have known better than to have, and I should have known better than to be able to let myself continue to have, and that I should have had a hell of a lot more willpower than to allow myself to wind up in a detox ward. All of these things were my perception of the woman alcoholic in 1973, not back in the dark ages, but in 1973. I think that this is an indication of how society perceives the woman alcoholic, and it's also how we perceive ourselves. And I hope that sessions like this will help to do something, and I'm sure they will, to change that image and to promote some understanding of this disease. Thank you.